Hi everyone, this is Lauren Petrovic, founder of Laurenti New York. Welcome to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. In this special series, we investigate the force of driving responsible consumption and production in the $360 billion luxury goods industry. Over this series, we sit down with extraordinary leaders to discuss market dynamics, product strategies, customer experiences, emerging technologies, and entry into Web3. The pressing need and increasing demand for systemic change to create a more sustainable and responsible jewelry industry is a consistent theme. In today's episode, I sit down with Parag Shah, a third-generation diamond tower who brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table. His journey in the diamond trade began in the 90s, steeped in a family legacy that values quality above all else. Over the past 30 years, Parag has witnessed the resilience of the diamond trade during economic downturns, the impact of emerging technologies, and disruptions in the midstream market.
One thing I know is that even through tough times, this industry is very resilient. We will have these challenges, but we'll always find a way. And we're getting to that slowly where, you know, from the manufacturing to the retail level, there is a harmony in how we work together to get the right message of the product that we're selling. There's very few things in life that are this special. We can do all this work on our level, but if it doesn't go down to consumer level, if it's not marketed properly, then it's all for waste. And that's the end game that I see, that if we're going to work this hard to know provenance and to do everything with blockchain, then there has to be a very simple way to emanate this information all the way down.
With a deep understanding of the industry's history and dynamics, Parag continues to navigate the ever-changing landscape as a seasoned diamond dealer in the midstream market. Parag brings a valuable perspective to today's discussion about the evolution of the diamond market and the future of traceability in the industry. Stay tuned this week as we explore the intricacies of the diamond trade and the path towards a more responsible and sustainable future from someone I consider to be a true industry expert. Here's Parag Shah on the Responsible Luxury Podcast. Hello, Parag. I am so happy to have you here. I remember we were talking about the initial idea for the show. You were one of the first people I came to with the idea, and you really were there to help make this happen. So happy to have you on today. Thank you for being here. So tell us a little bit about you and Gem International.
So I'm, as the story goes with a lot of diamond tearers, I'm a third generation diamond tearer. My grandfather started a private jewelry business in India, in Calcutta, actually, which is where many of the rich families in India used to live. And then at a fairly young age, I think around 18 or 19, my dad joined him in that business. But dad always had his sights on America. He loved America, mostly from, you know, watching some of the old Cary Grant and Elvis Presley and all those great movies from that era. And he knew that this is where he wanted to come. So in 1974, initially, he emigrated here alone. And then the rest of the family came in 1977. After a brief stint in the investment banking world from 1988 to 1990, I decided to enter the family business. So went to India for 7 months, studied assortment of diamonds, and got trained in buying. When back then, it was mostly a melee business, which is, you know, basically from your approximately one pointers up to 15, 16 pointers. So we used to separate them out by quality, you know, how to package the different qualities for it to be marketable in the US. So once I got that training, 1990 is when full-time I came into 47th Street, joined my dad. And at that time, he was partners with his brother, you know, Shah Diamonds. And, you know, that's where I got my start in the industry. and in the business, even though during the summers, during high school and college, I would come to the office, and I actually back then set up one of the first computer accounting systems in the diamond industry. It was an interesting time because computers, this is back in the DOS days and all that. So I always was around, like many Diamond Terrace kids, they were always around it, but it was really truly in 1990 that I joined full time. And then, here we are 34 years later. And although it feels like a blink of an eye, amazing how many changes just I have seen in my what feels like a short career. As far as how the business has changed, there's been so many changes, some gradual, some very, very quick. For those that can relate, back in the 80s and 90s, it was what we call a true wholesale business. We could bring an entire shipment of different qualities, and literally between two or three customers, you could sell your entire shipment. You would take an entire parcel of mixed sizes, and you could go in and sell to other dealers. There were some very big manufacturers that would buy also. So that has changed drastically. And that was, I think, one of the first changes. We went from like a real wholesale business to then, taking each parcel apart and supplying only what the customer wanted. And then in the 90s, the buzzword was just in time. So that was like something very new. You didn't have to plan a month or 2 months ahead of time. It was just in time. You needed something. It was a very, very short turnaround. You could find, individual sizes and all that. So that was, for us, at least initially, a very, very big change. And then with competition, the next big change was where wholesalers like ourselves, where we would manufacture or procure in large quantities overseas from manufacturers and then sell it wholesale here on 47th Street. Then we started branching out to outside of New York, and instead of selling to wholesalers, selling to manufacturers of jewelry. So you could make a little bit better profit, but then you had to break apart your parcels. Fast forward some more, that went to things like in the larger stones. There was no cut grades. You bought parcels of 1 carat, 1.5, 2 carats in a parcel. There was no individual, what's the depth, what's the table, what's the diameter. You sat there and you actually measured all of this yourself. And then you separated out and maybe you sold 5 stones to this person and a couple here, a couple. Now everything is already pre-measured. Most of the stones now that you buy from overseas are already GIA graded, have reports on them. You could see everything online. These progressions took a while, and some parts of the industry grasped it very quickly and they grew tremendously. And namely the Indian manufacturers, they went into transparency. They started grading each stone internally, having measurements and everything, so customers could come and work quickly. They didn't have to waste time sitting there and measuring. And I think that, yeah, and that's where I first started understanding transparency. And we use that for so many different aspects of the business now. But back then, to me, that
That's
was the
around
first
early
time.
2000s.
It was after the crash of 2000 here economically. We had boom period in the 90s, and then we had that tech bubble, we had Y2K, all of that. And then after that, you could see this progression come, that where transparency started, and it grew, it grew, it grew. And when import export rules were changed a little bit in India, where they could initially, I think it was through Rappaport or through a very specific manner, send stones to GIA for grading and have it allowed back into India. That was a game changer, because then the manufacturers started having their diamonds come with grading reports. they got the grade. We would be able to go there and buy non-certified stones. And if your eye was good, you were able to buy stones that you knew you were going to get a better grading here, you know? And so you were able to play that, and there was money to be made in that. So, you know, markets have become efficient. So that's the other thing, right? With technology, markets became very, very efficient, and much to a lot of people's chagrin, efficiency brought lack of profits. You know, there was a lot of room to make money because each person's eye was different back then, and the grading that one person saw to the other. Now everything's with a paper, so they, you know, it's priced based on what GIA puts on there with some. So it's, you know, and these are just some of the big changes that stand out in my eye. Obviously, what has happened over the last decade, that's an entire 2-3 hour conversation in and of itself.
Yes, and we're going to get into that and probably another episode too, because there's a lot wrapped up in there. There's a certain quote that I believe it's on your website, and I think it's also on your desk too. Quality is remembered well after price is forgotten. And I love this quote very much. And I want to ask you what it means to you and how this ties into your business.
So this is exactly what my grandfather, my father, and you know, I've just inherited that. Everything that we've ever done, whether it's been loose diamonds, whether it's been the small diamonds, or even the certified larger single stones, we've always excelled at finding the top end of each range. So it doesn't mean that we only deal with, you know, the internally flawless or VVS goods. No, but there's the upper echelon of SI1, there's the upper echelon of VS2s, there's the upper echelon of, and we take pride in finding and searching through the myriad of merchandise that is available out there and finding always the best. And then we've taken that into the jewelry I make. You know, for 30 years now, have been making machine set bands. And I always love the quality and the fact that time and time again, it's so consistent. And again, that fed into our quality mantra that you make a ring, but make it the best ring that you can. You know, and that methodology of manufacturing, short of doing a handmade ring, gives you value and gives you quality. I mean, I still tell customers today, jokingly, that our bands are so strong you can open up a paint can with it. You know, they're strong, they're meant to last. So that's what this whole thing about quality, that anything that you do, and you've been to my office, you know, I like my environment to just feel like you're walking into a place like, okay, this person has everything together. You know what I mean? It's just quality in everything that you do. You're always seeking the best within the realm of what you can afford to buy, and always aspiring for something a little bit better. And and you're right. I mean, I have it on my desk. I point it out to people that don't know me yet. I have it on the footer of all my emails, because when the conversation leads to price, I always turn that conversation to, is this a product that you're looking to, quote unquote, almost like ingest for today, and it makes you feel good to get the best price? Or is this something that you are meant to own for the next 20, 30, 40 years? And now that I've been in the industry for so long, I appreciate time. You know, I appreciate how fast it goes. You know, time goes fast. And when you have something of quality that you don't have to worry about over the next decade, 2 decades, you appreciate it so much more every time you take it out of your jewelry box, you know, or put it on your finger or around your neck. And it means a lot to me. It means a lot to me to do that. So I've, in my career, always gone towards quality, doing work that I enjoy rather than doing the mass business. And I've tried that. I've tried the mass business. My heart's not in it. And I did it for about 7 years in between, and just didn't enjoy it. So I came back to my roots because that's what was always calling.
And it certainly attracts a certain type of customer with that too. And with that, I want to turn the conversation slightly and talk about your customers and ultimately the end consumer. I think for a lot of listeners are not native to the jewelry industry. So it may be the intricacies that happen day in and day out may not be apparent. So, I think that there's still a lot of narratives going on in consumers' minds about the jewelry industry and the diamond business and how it's run, of course, without fully understanding the complexities. From your perspective, going into the industry's practices and ethics, we were talking about quality and just conducting business. Can you give us a better understanding of the industry and how it's run?
There's so many different levels of the industry, Lauren, that and maybe let me start with where I am in the food chain of the industry. So because even with the jewelry part of my business, I still am a diamond dealer. Most of my business is loose diamonds. I supply to stores and dealers and manufacturers across the country. So above me would be obviously the manufacturers, whether they are some manufacturers in Israel, mostly in India. Manufacturing is done in many places of the world. Obviously, you have diamonds that are being manufactured with beneficiation right there in Africa once it's mined in India, of course, Bangkok, a little bit in China, depending on the sizes. So my level is right below the manufacturer. We do some repairing of diamonds here in New York, but we don't really manufacture stones anymore like we used to 30 years ago. Economics, basically. So from that level, we have a viewpoint of multiple parts of the business. We have a viewpoint to the other dealers like myself. Right. And we share inventory, meaning that I don't have something that my client needs. I can go in and get it in on memo from other dealers like myself. Vice versa, somebody's making a piece of jewelry, they need my fine melee, they buy from me. So there's that layer. Then right below that is us selling to manufacturers of jewelry, entire lines, and then they're putting it out at the store. I supply directly to retail stores that do a lot of custom work. So the whole trend toward customization right at the retail level has been very good for our business because there was a trend a while back where manufacturing was moving overseas. So the need for melee in the United States was less and less. But with customization now at the retail level, a lot of that manufacturing has come back to the US, especially for the better quality, which is where we excel and where my specialty is. There is a small part of my business that the friends and family part of it that I do sell direct to B2C. It's on referrals. I really don't attract that type of business with online presence or anything like that. It's a referral business. And that part of the business, I have to tell you, brings a tremendous amount of joy because it's the only time that I actually get to see the look on someone's face when the final product is delivered, when that quality shines through, and when they see it on their finger, and they're like, wow, yes, you do make it better. And I think the message that you asked me about earlier about quality is appreciated long after price is forgotten has become more apparent to me as I've been able to deal with more private clients and being able to see their faces when we create a one-of-a-kind piece for them, or you know, they've envisioned something and we're able to bring it to fruition, or just even making that simple design, that simple black dress, but making it the best that we can.
Yes.
You know, and
it's going to truly last forever. That's going to stay in the family for generations. It's and being a part of that, knowing that you created that and contributed towards that is.
And, you know, so that's where Lauren, you know, where my business is. But I mean, the vertical integration is so seamless these days. You know, you have manufacturers from India that sell all the way down to the consumer through large online portals that we all know, you know, whether it's your Blue Nile, James Allen, you know, the where they have direct representation of their items down to the consumer. You have wholesalers that are also doing, have B2C sites. So they have an entire division that does that. And they're also providing wholesale to retail. So this is one of the few industries where really vertical integration is very, it seems so seamless because everybody is able to do almost everything, you know, minus going all the way out to someplace overseas and, you know, digging your own diamonds, which with the advent of lab grown, we've actually even gone into that stage now where, you know, we've diamond terrors have become diamond mines and all the way down to B2C presence. So that's, again, one of the huge changes in the industry that has really only happened in the last, what, 5 or 7 years?
Yeah, lab grown, I mean, coming out in when, like 2017?
That's where it really started getting traction. But I was actually a Series B investor in Gemesis, which was the original lab-grown company back in, I think I dug up the papers as I was going through it. I think we invested back in there in, I can't believe it was like 1998 or 1999. So that's how far back lab-grown goes. You know, back then we were only able to make yellows, orangey yellows, and all as technology went. Obviously, the Holy Grail was trying to perfect white, right? To perfect colorless, near colorless. And when that got perfected, that's when the trajectory of lab grown really, you know, that learning curve really became steep.
Looking at the lab grown market today, there's obviously distinction between natural diamonds and lab growns. But when you look at the value between both naturals and lab growns, and also considering sustainability factors, because there's claims about lab growns being more ethical and more environmentally friendly, which fully true. I think there's a little greenwashing there. But I think a bigger narrative that consumers may not be aware of is the social sustainability that natural diamonds provide to producing countries. What's your position on lab growns and naturals? I know you deal mostly with naturals, but what's your input?
So I do mostly deal with naturals, but we're a business, and my business is to take care of my customers. And look, I knew that there would be a place for lab grown at some point in this industry. Otherwise, I would not have invested in Gemesis 25 years ago. You know, before people even knew what a lab grown diamond was, or, you know, it was just a thought, you know, a side conversation. So I knew that it was coming, but I never really, even though I invested in them, I never really sold the product to my clients. Okay. Because as Gem International, I knew where my focus was. But as lab grown became more and more popular and customers, especially my customers, started asking me for it, we partnered up with a couple of large manufacturers, and we would be able to dip into their inventory as we needed. So I never really stocked lab grown. It was more of, call it a concierge service that I provided to clients, and still the same keen eye, because in lab grown, in the early days, there was wide variations in quality. There was, you know, brownish tones, there were bluish tones, there were stones with dark graphite looking imperfections in them. So my job was still to do what I do for them on the natural side, is to, if they ask for a VS2 stone, to find them a proper VS2 stone. So whether it was natural or lab grown, my job was very, very similar. So as far as a business standpoint, that's where we are. We sell both. As far as the messaging, I think that's where lab grown really, I mean, I understand they went after the low-hanging fruit, which is you piggyback on the natural diamond, and that's what helped them grow. But I think we've gotten to a point now where they need to stand on their own, because the economics of pricing, to still be quoting prices based off of Rappaport when you're doing 98 below Rappaport, means nothing. You're charging 2% of the rap price. There's so many things that lab grown could do that natural cannot, and I think that's where that part of the industry is already. You could see it starting to veer towards that point. I never believed in the whole eco-friendly, because I'm very well versed in where these stones come from, what kind of energy it takes. I've seen, even from the early days, our lab or factory, call it, down in Sarasota, Florida, with all the machines, the amount of water, the amount of electricity. Obviously, technology has changed, and there's improvements on that, but still, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to produce a lab-grown stone. And not everybody is putting up solar panels to power their factories. So I think that each individual case, as far as how eco-friendly or carbon neutral, or that needs to be done on a company-to-company base, just like you would in any other industry. So that messaging, I think, is wrong. And where the natural industry is getting much better now, but I think there was a gap before, is the wonderful message of what the resources in some of the poorest countries in the world allow them to do for their people. And I think, and you and I, we've talked about it in the past, look at what Botswana has been able to do for their country, where healthcare is free, education is free. This is with the help of diamonds. Diamonds make up about 25% of their GDP, if I'm not mistaken. I know it's a tremendously large part of their economy, and all the conservation they do on their lands. There's so much of a beautiful story around natural diamonds and what it means and symbolizes and beauty, that we're getting better at sharing that message. But I think it has to also be grassroots down to store level, where,
Brands and sharing this whole narrative of the entire chain of custody of the diamonds.
exactly. How beautiful, what the benefits are to the countries where it comes from, and just the whole ecosystem that it supports, within the industry, from all the diamond cutters to, forget about the business level guys, but just from diamond cutters, the people that work at the mines on down.
I want to switch gears and ask about Russian sanctions. Most recently was the effect of March 1st of traceability on carats, 1 carat and above of diamonds. Can you share how you think this is going to affect business operations, starting from your perspective, being in the midstream business? I know that there's talks right now of the G7 certificate scheme and how that's going to play out, where that's going to be certified, how that's going to be certified with technology. And then ultimately, once it's past the borders, where this traceability is going to happen, how it's affecting retailers and ultimately the end consumer. So firstly, how is the Russian sanctions affecting your business right now?
So specifically for my business, it really hasn't affected at all. From 2022, when the war started, and there was a lot of the luxury brands had already told their suppliers that they do not want any Russian diamonds. They want that to be segregated out of their supply chain. And we had also made a conscious effort to do the same with our suppliers, especially for diamonds that were individual GIA stone, because most of my suppliers, at least, do show provenance of where the rough origin, what the rough origin was for the stone. So over time, the suppliers that have that information readily available became more important in my portfolio as opposed to the others. So we were already kind of in the mix of that. And I think for the US so far, the requirement that we have of self-certification is a fairly easy, at least on a paperwork side of things, it's fairly easy to provide. You get the same certification from your suppliers from the other side when a shipment is coming to you, and then you provide it to people like Malcolm Mead or Brinks, whoever you bring in the merchandise with. So that part of it is, from my standpoint, from my specific business, has been fairly smooth. I know that there's anecdotal information out there where people's shipments have been delayed. Again, we don't know all the information as to what paperwork they provided, if it was accurate, if something had to be changed. So, you know, it's human nature. Something gets delayed a couple of days. I'm not saying that there aren't specific pockets with more trouble or longer delays, but sometimes even if there's a 1 or 2 day delay, you know, people like to complain, oh, you know, my shipment was delayed, because our industry during COVID had no delays. Everybody else felt supply chain issues. Our industry, because we've always flown in our merchandise, you know, we 5 days, oh my God, you know, we were like up in arms if it took 5 days to get our merchandise. So, you know,
I'm laughing in some ways, and some of the fashion business, their clothes were stuck there for like 2 or 3 months at a time. It was
exactly. So, you know, I'm like, sometimes, you know, you have these random thoughts in your, I'm like, you know, we're a bunch of children. I mean, we're like crying over a 5 day lag on something, but we have, again, we got so used to this just in time type of process that yes, it makes a difference. Every day counts in our industry. So I understand that sanctions, the paperwork that's necessary, nobody enjoys doing this.
It's just an extra statement on the invoice that says this is of non-Russian origin. Is that right?
Yes, it's actually a specific letter that you have to provide. It's a separate letter, not just on your invoice. Yeah. It's actually a separate letter that you provide your customs broker or, you know, the shipping agent, like I said, the Malcolm Mead brings those kind of companies, where it says that any of the merchandise in this shipment that is 1 carat in over is not from Russian origin, and also not Russian origin that has been, you know, cut and polished in some other country. So basically, anything that started in Russia is not allowed due to the sanctions. So from going, you know, from my business standpoint, it hasn't been that difficult. But where is this going? That's really the concern of everybody, that this was just a starting off period. Is this going to get more difficult, or is there's going to be more checks and balances? Right now, all we have to say, it's not Russian. In the future, are we going to have to show where it's actually from? So a lot of work is being done on the manufacturer side in the back end, where countries like a Botswana that have such a positive message and don't want to get embroiled in all of this, they are figuring out a way to have all their rough and all the stones that get manufactured right there in Botswana and all that to have kind of like that mark that this is a Botswana diamond, that automatically, you know, those kind of stones will have its provenance on the paperwork. And so I think we're moving more and more in that direction. And I know from the manufacturers that I deal with that any stones over a carat, and usually even over 3/4 of a carat that I get in, have very specifically where the rough originated. So I think that will be helpful going forward. You know, when September 1st comes around, and the next, when it goes from a carat and above to 50 points and above.
You know, despite the challenges of the pushes on traceability, there is an incredible opportunity here for the industry to advance and start to adapt more to the technology, because being mm-hmm. able to track the entire provenance and supply chain through different technology is going to be a big value add for a lot of stakeholders within the industry, not just retail, mm-hmm. but, you know, just scaling that from mine to market. And thinking of Canada has their Canadian mark diamonds. Botswana's in talks about having their origin stamp on their mine diamonds. Do you see origin being a new value add for diamonds?
I think it will. Yeah, you know, it's tough to answer that, because to me, the inherent beauty of the diamond, regardless of where it comes from, is more important than where it came from. Even in the diamond world, even though it's not in writing and it's not on any reports, there are stones that just have a very, very fiery, bright look to them. Some of them are dull, you know, and to me, those kind of things are more important than where they come from. But now that we are putting such a value on knowing where the diamond came from, mainly because of the sanctions, I feel like there will be a marketing play when it comes to the provenance of these stones, exactly what kind. Now, I can definitely see a story where, okay, if a country like Botswana, because of them being able to market the fact that look at all the good that diamonds have done, is there a value added for people to buy a Botswana diamond? Yes, there is. I feel like at that point, if I'm feeding into something very positive, I'm going to feel positive about it. And at the same time, seek out a very beautiful diamond from that country. And it could be the same with Canada. If you have some attachment to that, and there's some beautiful, beautiful stones that come from Canada. I do carry some Canada Mark stones and other stones that come from the Ekati mine in Canada that don't come with Canada Mark. But, you know, we know the provenance. And those, so there's beautiful stones that come out of Angola, Namibia, South Africa. There's stones that come, beautiful stones that come from many countries. And by answering yes, there's a value in that, I don't want to diminish the value of the other countries' diamonds that are also doing right by their people, their land, doing things the right way in mining diamonds. So what scares me more than the value brought by all of this is the fact that, does this diminish the value of the stone that I got from grandma? Because I don't know exactly where that was mined. You know, does it diminish the value of all the beautiful diamonds that were bought in the past are now in people's safe deposit boxes, people wear every day? And to me, that's a bigger question. How would you feel if you go to sell and people are only willing to pay you 20% less than what they would for a new stone of exactly the same quality, just because they know what where the new, right? Yeah, not so much uncertified. Like, you would have a GIA report also that says one, you know, a quality, and you have a new stone of that quality. Yeah, but the provenance.
Sanctions.
Yeah. So you don't have, you wouldn't know that, okay, your grandmother's stone came from, let's say it was mined in South Africa. You don't know that. The other one that you have in your hand, which is worth X percent more, you know where it came from. Is that, and I'm not the person to answer the question, the market will, you know, the consumer will, but is that worth more, and by how much more, than not knowing where your grandmother's stone came from? And that's, to me, that could be the real problem. You know, if it's 2, 3, 4, 5%, okay, it's not a big deal. But if it becomes a bigger gap down the road, that could be a a problem, and it deteriorates your confidence, because today it's this rule. What if there's another rule 10 years down the road? Well, does that negate everything that we're doing today?
It's definitely a big question mark. And it's quite a concern too, because of all the inventory some people may have on hand. And of course, the consumers with their family heirlooms, what's going to happen with the value of that? I'm curious to know about the technology and systems that you have in place for traceability in GEM International supply chain. Can you go into your sourcing protocol and how you go about finding and sourcing stones?
Sure. So for us, again, because we're on the upper spectrum of the kind of diamonds that we deal in, we've over the last few years, and especially fast forward the last 2 years since the war, shortened our list of suppliers to the ones that have a clear trail and are very transparent with where the rough came from for each individual stone that we look at and then eventually purchase. So not only do we have it from them on an individual basis, so that all gets downloaded into our own software and that's held there. So if we need to, even 5 years down the road, and I can tell you from stones 5 years ago, if you ask me, okay, what are all the Canadian stones you sold? We have a search parameter within, because we fill in all that information within our own inventory software. It comes on the invoices that our suppliers send us, or the backup material that comes with it, be it a Excel spreadsheet with all the information on that stone, everything from images to rough origin to all the details on the stone, including a copy of the GIA report so you can correspond the GIA report number with the rough origin. And then we have that information. Of course, if our retail partners ask us, we have it. It's listed actually on B2B websites that we list our inventory. There is a column there for origin, so they can click on that and see that as well. So we do have a pretty clear paper trail. Our levels are not too much. So from supplier manufacturer to us down to our customer, we have all of that information, and it's basically three levels, right? Three levels of information that I need. I think the manufacturers are doing a very good job, especially in India. I can speak for India, because most of my purchases of the bigger stones, the Carat Plus, is from there. And I can definitely say that they do a very good job and have over the last 20 years in transparently marketing their production.
I want to make the connection with sustainability, because I think there's so many different conversations going in within sustainability. I see the younger customers much more engaged and keen on wanting to know the origin of, and of course, like the sustainability of the piece versus the older audience that I serve. The origin and where the stone came from isn't really crossing their mind. That's not really a value add for them. But when I look at sustainability in the diamond and jewelry business, I see, of course, there's the environmental perspective, but there's also the people human perspective, thinking long term of what sustainability is. I'm curious to hear your vision for sustainability within the broader luxury market and your thoughts on what sustainability means to you as an individual in this world and also scaling from your business, moving forward, adopting more sustainable practices.
I've actually thought a little bit about this, and I know in many ways the jewelry industry gets a lot of maybe bad press. Maybe I'm seeing it, more on the B2B level. I don't know what the consumer views of us, but we do actually, if you think about it, compared to a lot of other industries, we do a darn good job of being sustainable. So sustainable, what does it mean to me? You think about it. We sell diamonds. Diamonds don't get thrown away. Okay. You own a piece from 100 years ago. Either it still exists today in its same form because it's a collector's item, it's a signed piece, whatever, or it has been broken out. Let's say all the gemstones have been taken out. The gold has been melted, reused in something. And the gemstones are still around in maybe one new piece, in multiple new pieces. I can't do that with clothes and shoes and so many other things. What ends up with that? It ends up in the garbage can. It goes to a landfill. You know, you don't like a ring? You melt down the ring. You make something else that you want. You're not creating. Yes. Do we have to dig up more gold? Do we have to dig up more diamonds or create more diamonds in the lab? Yes, we do. Because as the population grows, more and more people want the product. You cannot service them only through material that gets recycled. But we do supply a lot of the market with the recycled. So we're doing a pretty good job with whatever material is allowed to come back into the system. And there's companies that specialize in that. And I know you've probably had conversations with them, people that recycle, break out diamonds from old jewelry, and then it goes on auction, and you know it goes right back into the system. Okay, so now let's look at it on the corporate side of things. What can we do for our organizations to be? And I think that's a little bit more on the manufacturing side, where you do have that whole manufacturing aspect of it, right? Where you're using a lot of energy for cutting wheels and all that. On my level, let's talk about, you know, something that I'm familiar with is the mid-market diamondaire that sits in an office. What is it that, what carbon footprint do we bring to this planet in doing what we're doing? Okay. So our offices, the way that they're run, they're like, you know, they're like corporate offices. So you want to make sure that you're recycling product, you're not wasting things that are boxes that are coming into the office, things like that. You know, I don't think, as far as jewelry is concerned, there's not a lot of wastage in general. Shipping material is probably our biggest vice, is to send this small little item. You know, you're double boxing, you
Yeah,
know,
product
FedEx
boxes. Yeah.
boxes, and putting it in a pet pack, which is plastic, and all of that. And on a personal level, we've tried to be very, very aware of it, because I could tell you on a personal level, nothing bothers me more than driving down my street and on cardboard pickup day, just seeing Amazon boxes lined up, you know, on both sides of the street. And I'm like, how is this good for the, I mean, this did not happen before when you actually went to a store and bought a bag full of stuff. So, you know, there's always an internal fight I think everybody has with themselves also, that we want to do the right thing, but then we also want what we want, right? We want it right away and all that. So there's that battle. But I think on an individual business level and mid-level diamond tier, I think overall, compared to most of the industries out there, I think we do a very, very good job in how small our carbon footprint is for the economic value that we bring. And once again, going back to our product, I don't think there is wastage in our product at all. So talk about sustainable. Our product is so much more sustainable than clothing, handbags, all these perfumes, and you know, the whole cosmetic industry. So we're much, much more sustainable because, first of all, because of its high value, nothing gets wasted. So on a broader scale, sustainability, whenever I hear that word, and like you said, it's a suitcase word, right? And it goes, you know, I always come to my saying here about how quality is. Remember, I tell my kids, I tell everybody in the house that buy a quality product that lasts instead of buying five things, you know. And I can give you the example from the fast fashion world. You don't need to buy five blouses, you know, five shirts, because the price is so low. Buy three that are real top-notch quality, and every time you put it on, you feel like $1 million. And Does that do a very small drop in the bucket of sustainability in the sense that I'm going to waste less clothes, there's going to be less garbage out there, whatever I can do, even at home, little things. And I think the luxury world needs to embrace a little bit of that and to understand that how do we make our products so that, yes, they're very valuable, right? I mean, luxury products, no matter what it is, clothes or bags or shoes, their jewelry, it is, you pay a lot of money for it. Is there a way that can turn around and not thrown away or end up in garbage somewhere? What can we do to reduce having to create more and more and more and use up more and more resources? Now, I know there's a balance between economics and people having jobs, I mean, but we have to find that balance somehow long run. And, how as a society do we start understanding how do we do this better? What do we do in our lives to make things a little better? And when you look at something like that and you look at your own pile of garbage that you put out to say, okay, how can I reduce this? Because we can't put all the burden on the companies above us that sell us the product to always do the right thing if we ourselves are not ready to do the right thing, to figure things out. So, on the luxury company level, where we can be a little bit more responsible, I think we have to look at every aspect of our business. And I think they are. Honestly, I do believe the top brands around the world do look everything from their packaging to their internal thing. But I think it can be done better. I know when you buy an expensive watch, it needs to come in a beautiful box, but it doesn't need to come in a $3,000 wood from some rare tree type of a box. Yes, it makes you feel good, but look, I can only speak for me. I don't know what the right answer is. Obviously, there's going to be enough people that are going to say no. When it's luxury, it's got to be like this, and whatever it takes to package it, to make it look like it belongs, and that's correct. But then you have to make that decision. Is the sustainability doing certain things the right way? What's smart for the ecosystem and all that? Is that more important, or is this more important? And I think we all fight with that balance. Just within ourselves, we fight with that balance, right?
Yeah. If we look towards the future, how to build a better world for the next generation to work, live, and operate in, my thesis is getting these transactions on chain will lift up and elevate the market in a sense. Thinking of what the end game is going to be with this traceability, going back to what the sanctions and G7 certification scheme is going to look like, what are customers demanding? What are they asking for? And at the end of the day, what do we want to see achieved with this? Because we have incredible potential with some of this, the emerging technologies in the business. What's your thoughts and what's your vision for the future when it comes to where we are now, where we want to go with traceability and how we could get there together?
I think we're the arrows are pointing in the right direction. I think we need to get the systems integrated
Yeah, the checks and
better.
balances need to be there too.
The checks and balances. So the way that we rely on a GIA report, it would be wonderful to have something coordinated with that because the manufacturer already knows where the rough origin is. And if everything is on a blockchain, that blockchain can be shared with GIA when you submit the stone for grading. And then GIA, because of the blockchain and that assurance, can put it on their report that the stone is from this origin. In some ways, similar to what happens in the gem world, where there are telltale signs in rubies and sapphires and other gems as to where that product came from. So it's right there on the certificate itself, rather than having to follow a GIA report and then to have to follow a blockchain. My whole thing with this process is how do we get that message to consumer level? So far, everything we've been doing is at our level, which is mid-market level.
Very technical, very technical
Yeah, very
levels.
exactly. Canada Mark was about the closest thing to where, with the diamond, with this GIA report or whatever other report, there was a card, a Canada Mark card with a laser inscription, and it told you what your rough diamond weighed and all that. I do have a couple of suppliers that provide a diamond DNA where you get a picture of what the rough looked like before they either sawed it or, and then how it was planned and your final product and where the rough came from. And so it's trickling in. Now, how I am able to have my retail partners convey that to the consumer level, that's the key. We can do all this work on our level, but if it doesn't go down to consumer level, if it's not marketed properly, then it's all for waste. And that's the part that's the end game that I see, that if we're going to work this hard to know provenance and to do everything with blockchain, then there has to be a very simple way to emanate this information all the way down. And I think they're working on it. De Beers with their tracer system is working on it. Everything can be done with a QR code. If it's on the blockchain, you should be able to do the QR code and know the whole history of the diamond. So I think it's coming. I think it's coming. I know we would have liked to have seen this yesterday, but because of all the moving parts in our industry and the way that diamond rough is traded, diamond polished is traded, it makes it a little bit more of a challenge to integrate everything, but it is happening. And as more value is given to the value of the diamonds that have these provenance reports with them, you'll see more people join. I don't think people are convinced yet that with all the added costs will come anything extra except for just added cost. And that's why, except for the most forward-thinking of companies, I think a lot of people have held back a little bit.
With the traceability, I think with Serene and Tracer, in order for customers to get on board and aligned, it's how can they personally relate to the piece of jewelry? You know, how can we humanize it in a way that they feel? So it's like, I think the gap here is connecting the provenance of their stone to the provenance of their journey moving forward on. They own this piece, their daughter's going to own this piece, their granddaughter's going to own this piece, and so on and so forth. So I think that's going to be a big effort on the retailer side. Thinking more also into the future, what are your hopes and predictions for the future of our industry in terms of sustainable development and responsible practices?
I'm very, very positive in what's going on in within the industry. It's very easy to always point your finger at when something goes wrong. It's human nature. That's what we like to report, the things that have gone wrong. But if you look at what is going correct and where we were and where we are today, there's a lot of positive about our industry when it comes to sustainability, to just being good corporate citizens. I know these are some of the words, but to me, it's just being you in personal life being a good citizen, you in business being a good corporate citizen, doing things the right way. And we've come a tremendous, and especially I have to say, this last decade, we've come leaps and bounds. I'm blessed to have seen this industry over a 4-decade period. And this last decade in how far we have come technologically, also being so mindful of the planet around us, but so mindful of the people around us. I'm very positive on where we're going to go with this. And now that everybody's mind is put on this, I don't think that we have a long way to go before we achieve some of the things that we just said, that to be able to, with a quick QR code, to be able to see exactly what the journey of your diamond was or your piece of jewelry was. And you mentioned Serene, which I had not mentioned, but Serene does a phenomenal job. You know, they have their Serene journey. They're one of the main companies that does the mapping of rough diamonds on what's the best way to cut and polish them, what's the best way to get yield out of that. So they have a tremendous amount of data on millions and millions of diamonds every year that get cut and polished. So they're also a great company to help with this technological process to get us to a point where I want to feel confident. Even when I get a stone from overseas, I won't be able to zap that barcode on the parcel paper and see all the information on my screen and not have to log into somebody's proprietary website.
Traceability is obviously a huge jump and get everyone on board with the full-scale traceability. Of course, there's that in mind, but thinking of other primary challenges the industry is dealing with, what are some challenges that you see that we still need to overcome in order to, achieve a better future moving forward?
Always when that question is asked to me, to me, it's always the economic challenge. For us to be able to do everything as an industry, to invest in the R&D that's necessary to bring new things to light, to go after new endeavors, there has to be economic viability, first of all, in the industry, which from the latter half of 22 and 23 has been a big, big challenge for the industry. And you can look at it at every level. You know, look at it from the mining companies, how they've performed. And that's, you know, just a reflection of also how mid-market has performed. So to me, the economic challenge, Lauren, has been the difficult part of our industry. But at the same time, look, we've always managed. You know, I started in the industry during a recession. You know, 90, 91 was a recession, to the crash, the dot-com crash, to the economic collapse, to so many, to COVID, to all that. One thing I know is that even through tough time, this industry is very resilient. So yes, we will have these challenges, but we'll always find a way to navigate them. Challenges as far as the overall topic of sustainability, traceability, the challenge that we have in our industry is balancing the way that business was done to the way that we ideally want to see this business go. Okay, so there's this whole push and pull that is constantly happening. And it's also one of the reasons for things moving along slowly. You have thousands and thousands of players on the mid-level, right? So the big manufacturers, the mining companies can all get together, and it's a lot easier for that level to achieve what they need to. But when you get down to the thousands of wholesalers, and then you get down to retail level, thousands and thousands of retailers, you know, at last count by Jewelers Board of Trade, over 17,000 retailers just in the US, let alone the rest of the world. That's where the challenge is, to get the message down to the people that have done business in a certain way, and now to teach them that this is important,
Well,
be more
it's been
forward-thinking.
passed.
Yeah, it's a perfect example of how lab grown went into the market. You had people that were holdouts, 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 because they were thinking past that, no, the diamond industry or the jewel, it has to be natural. And it wasn't until the consumer demanded from them, would walk into the store, do you have lab grown diamond, that they realized that they had to be in it. You know, and yes, you can make a decision that you don't want to carry it and give your clients a reason why, but the fact is that you have to be forward thinking. And I think that this is what the challenge is going to be, that the upper part of the industry, the higher up on the vertical chain, we will achieve traceability. We're doing so much for sustainability within our industry as organizational sustainability. Our product, like I told you, I think is very sustainable. It's the organization around it, it's the creation of it, it's the other inputs that we have to be mindful for. But that part of it is being worked on a regular basis. It's, I think, mid-level and down to retail that the message has to be there stronger and stronger, and they have to, over time, they will have to do their part to really put the message to the consumer, build confidence with the consumer that here's
Trust.
an industry
Yeah.
that no trust.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's the right word. Build trust with the consumer that we are, as an industry, doing things the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been in the business for so long, for decades, and you've mentioned many times to me before this business has existed for generations and still thrives on trust between two companies, two people, and a handshake. And trust in who you're doing business with across the table, whether you're a retailer doing business with a consumer, that element of trust is extremely important.
Well, time has definitely flown by,
Yeah.
and there's one final question which I ask at the end of each episode. And the question is, if you could visually depict the ideal state for the industry, what would it convey? And what values would it promote? Think of a big billboard in the middle of Times Square, and you have the complete creative freedom to splash on there whatever you wish.
As far as creativity, you're talking to the wrong guy. What I envision of the industry on a maybe on a more objective level, this industry is so diverse, so a vision for one side of it is not going to correlate with another aspect of it. I'm going to speak from my little corner of the industry, mid-level diamond tier, loose diamond dealer. And for our level, definitely on an economic level and all that, I want there to be a system, and we're getting to that slowly where, from the manufacturing to the retail level, there is a harmony in how we work together to get the right message of the product that we're selling. And because I'm on the up on a little bit on the higher side, just the inherent beauty and specialness of what we do, the message of, just think about the amount of man hours, the amount of hard work that goes into preparing that one little 2-point diamond or even that 2-carat diamond before it even gets to the point of being in front of someone to be able to view it from, think about it
All these
from,
slivers of people from their
yeah.
mind.
And I don't know, on a billboard, if I could somehow convey that. And even though the ad didn't run for very long, there was an ad that De Beers did a few years ago called Re Real is Rare. And it started with somebody finding a rough diamond in a cave, thousands of years ago. And then the journey of that diamond to really appreciate from when that stone is found to then having to go somewhere to get aggregated, to assort it, so that entire journey, even before it's a thought in someone's mind that I want to get engaged, that journey has already begun before the thought is even in someone's mind that they want to get engaged or they want to buy a piece of jewelry. That beauty and that specialness, that if we could figure out a way to convey that, to give people like goosebumps thinking about, like, this is absolutely amazing on the number of hands that it goes through and the effort it goes through. And then what are you left with? You have this little 2-point diamond or 1-point diamond that goes into a ring, and it's a part of 100 others in that ring. Something we take for granted, like, okay, I just ordered this and oh, here it is. And you put it. No, that whole objective part of it if we put that aside and actually think about what it goes through to get it, it should be treated that way.
Yes.
It should be treated as something so, so special. There's very few things in life that are this special.
Just a deep connection between people and the product, and between
yes.
people and people, and the industry again is just run on lifelong connections and
yes.
those relationships that, you know, are
So on a creative level, now that I've said that part out, on a creative level, I would love to show somehow the story of the people, the story of the people that actually touch it. So the person that mined it, what is his family? What is his life or her life, right? Then to the cutters, what is it? Them. I want to concentrate on them and not the business people in between, not your mining company owners and not your, you know, manufacturer owners, but the people that actually touch and bring value on a daily basis on the ground. Exactly. Even if you just start with that, I think that's just a spectacular story. And I really do envision one day this industry doing a very, very good job with showcasing that. And I'm hoping in some ways that this whole thing with sanctions and traceability and all that is the kick that the industry needs to say that, hey, you know what? This is what we need. This is the really true passion of why diamonds are so special. Gems, you know, diamonds, gems, you know, are so special. It's really something very, very unique. You know, try to look through any other products that you use in your life that come anywhere close to this. I don't think you can find it.
No, our industry is something very unique and, you know, many more stories to share.
Yeah.
Well, that was a perfect way to leave off today. Parag, any last words, comments, or remarks to leave with us today?
Yeah, Lauren, I wish you a lot of success on your podcast. I enjoyed our conversations before, and I think you're definitely on the right track in tackling topics other than what I normally hear on a lot of the podcasts from the industry, which are more, you know, news related or, you know, reporting. So I'm looking forward to your journey also with this, and I look forward to hearing your series once you release it.
Thank you. And best of luck to you. And we'll see each other again soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can catch more Responsible Luxury Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and the Laurenti New York Media page. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at concierge@laurentinewyork, and I'll link that down in the show notes below. Or you can connect with me directly on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. Let us come together to transform the future of responsible luxury. See you next week.